Well, thank you very much for coming. And today we will talk about Judge Pow and the independence of judicial authority. But we will get there by a roundabout way. The type of high school I attended as a teenager in the late 1950s and early 1960s in the Netherlands was called a gymnasium and included both Latin and Greek as part of the curriculum. The final 2 years of its program were divided into two streams called respectively Alpha and Beta. The program in the Alpha stream heavily emphasized the classics, and students spent most of their time reading authors in Latin and Greek. The program in the Beta stream combined the classics with the sciences. In those days, the only university programs that required Gymnasium Alpha as a precondition for entrance were the classics and theology. I would have preferred to take Gymnasium Alpha, but my teachers and my parents convinced me that I choose Gymnasium Beta, and I did. In the final years of Gymnasium Beta, our readings in the classics were limited to Homer and Ovid. And since that time, I have been fascinated by epic poetry. But for somebody in Chinese studies, that is not necessarily a convenient addiction. Because of the eminent position of the epic in the earliest phase of development in ancient Sanskrit and ancient Greek literature, and the prominent place of epic poetry also in some Western European traditions, it has been suggested at times in Western scholarship that all great literary traditions started with epic poetry. For anyone with only a superficial knowledge of non-Western literature, it's obvious that that is not true. Whatever the Book of Odes may be, it is not an epic. Nevertheless, there have been attempts to interpret the Book of Odes, or at least a number of songs in that collection, as an epic with Chinese characteristics. But even if we reject such scholarship as misguided, that does not mean that Chinese literature does not have a long tradition of narrative poetry. The earliest conspicuous example of this tradition is the anonymous poem Kong Chue Tung Nan Fei, Southeast Flies the Peacock, which was written sometimes during the 3rd to 5th centuries. And my word of tradition here is deliberate, because during the heyday of the oral formulaic theory some decades ago, Hans Frankl published an article in which he showed how extensively the anonymous author of Kong Chue Tung Nan Fei relied on a pre-existing system of formulas and formulaic phrases in the good tradition of oral epic poetry. Some scholars of the Ming and Qing dynasties had already earlier noticed the similarity of Kong Chue Tung Nan Fei and the popular narrative ballads of their own time. Some of these works of narrative verse of later times reach an enormous length, especially in the female author Tanzi or plucking rhymes of the Qing dynasty. In its modern edition, Li Kui Yu's Liu Hua Meng or Pomegranate Flower Dream runs to 10 volumes of each more than 600 pages, each containing over 100 lines of 7-syllable verse. Probably the longest verse composition in any language in the world. I've not tried to read it. Among popular genres of performed narrative, there is no lack of genres that tell their stories all in verse, but many other genres prefer the prosimetric format in which passages in prose alternate with passages in verse. Because the passages in prose are narrated in a more or less natural voice, while the sections in verse are chanted or sung, the collective Chinese term for this body of literature is shuochangwenshui or jiangchangwenshui, which can be conveniently translated with the French term chante fable literature, or prosimetric literature. The earliest examples of prosimetric narrative are found among the Pianwen transformation text, I mean, I'm limiting myself here to Chinese case because there's a long-standing discussion whether the Shanta Fabula format, the prosimetric format in the Chinese case is derived from the Indian example. People like Victor Mayer are strong proponents of that. But then he believes everything in China it comes from India. The ballad stories, which I discussed last week, that were discovered in 1967, are also an example of prosimetric narrative. Passages in prose alternate with passages in seven-syllable verse, and on rare occasions also 10-syllable verse. In view of the heroic stature of a character like Judge Pao, I would be happy to designate this type of text as epics with Chinese characteristics. If Chinese scholars are less inclined to do so, it may be because that for many of them, the epic still is closely associated with an early phase of social development, so it's fine for contemporary national minorities to have epics, but not for Chinese of the late imperial period. Peasants, of course, excluded. Prosimetric literature is usually considered part of popular literature. Such a classification tends to ignore the historical development of the genre, and for the late imperial period, the wide variety of genres and the variety within each genre. Pianwen, or transformation text, which were performed at the courts of Chang'an and Luoyang, Dunhuang and Urumqi, may well have been very similar in function, authorship and audience to the epic traditions of medieval Europe before the invention of printing. Following the invention of printing, individual members of the cultural elite increasingly turned to reading for instruction and entertainment, while the almost simultaneous development of drama, both East and West, had a large impact on the audiences of storytelling. Drama being much more interesting, but also much more expensive than storytelling. In many countries of Europe, the medieval epics were almost completely forgotten during the Renaissance and later, and had to be rediscovered during the 19th century in times of a romantic nationalism. And in China, too, prosimetric literature would appear to have become a truly popular literature, largely ignored by the elite, only with the late imperial period of the Ming and Qing. Even so, some of the works in this tradition show remarkable skill and remind us that literary talent is not limited to those who had achieved the Jinxi degree. Among the ballad stories on Judge Pao, too, we can observe great differences in terms of plotting, characterization, and description. One of my personal favorites is the tale of the case of Dragon Design Pao sentencing the emperor's brothers-in-law. Among the members of the Cao family, the author carefully differentiates the characterization of the arrogant Lady Cao, who fights to save the life of her younger son, her younger son, who is a weak-spined, spoiled brat, her much more world-wise and careful elder son, and her dutiful daughter, the Empress. The blanket characterization of prosimetric narrative as popular literature also hides the regional differences in status and function. It would appear, for instance, that Shantung intellectuals of the long 17th century were much more open to prosimetric narrative than the Jiangnan literati during the same period. Actually, one of the very few famous authors also to leave a large body of prosimetric narrative under his own name is the Shantung author Pu Songling, 1640 to 1715, well known to practically all of you, I presume, as the author of the Liao Jai Ji, a large collection of miracle tales. But Pu Songling is also the author of a number of so-called Li Qu, or rustic songs, which are now easily accessible because they have not only been included in the most recent version of his complete works, but also have been published collectively in a separate volume as the Liao Jai Li Qu. If Pu Songling wrote his classical tales for his gentleman friends, he wrote his rustic songs for a much broader audience, starting with the mother of his employer. This becomes very obvious in those rustic songs that are rewrite writings of tales from Liao Zhaijie. Bu Songling's Hanshen Qu, a song of the underworld, for instance, is based on two tales, Xiang San Quan and Xi Fang Ping. Both these tales are named after their main characters. The first tale tells the story of a young girl who takes revenge on the local bully who has murdered her father by disguising herself as a female impersonator when the local magistrate fails to punish the man. And the second tale also describes a search for justice, both in this world and the underworld, that turn out to be equally corrupt. But what is suggestion in the classical tales is spelled out in details in the rustic song that become an all-out attack on the pervasive corruption in the judicial system, both in this world and the underworld. Interestingly, the Liao Zhai Li Chu Ji, which I mentioned above, includes an extensive preface by a man called Zhou Zongliang, which not only highly praises Bu Songling for his critical spirit, which everybody does, but goes on to blame the pervasive corruption of traditional Chinese society on the absence of Montesquieu's separation of powers in traditional China. As we all know, the Chinese Communist Party, for all its talks about rule by law, still thinks that a separation of powers is a bad idea for China. Now, as long as one thinks that crime is an incidental problem due to individual lust and greed, judicial independence, seen from the perspective of the Chinese state, may not be a major issue. As a representative of the imperial government, the magistrate, once aware of the crime, will catch the culprit, extract a confession, and execute the law. This is what happens in the Judge Bao plays that were performed at the Ming Imperial Court. In practice, the central government was not concerned that a magistrate might have too little power and independence, but that he might have too much and act in an arbitrary fashion. In cases involving the death penalty, the judgment had to be revised repeatedly and eventually submitted to the emperor in person, to the great admiration of Western observers like the Jesuits. The system of mandated revisions, which could postpone an execution by years, provided, of course, numberless new opportunities for corruption at each level, as we learn from the opening chapters of the Xingxi Yinyuan Zhuan, a marriage to warn the world, an anonymous novel, occasionally attributed to Bu Songling, that describes social life in 17th century Shantung countryside in great detail. But if one believes that corruption spreads from the center and only expands with the increasing effectiveness of government, and that the criminals are first of all to be found within the administration, judicial authority and independence becomes an urgent issue. It should therefore come as no surprise that some of the ballad stories on Judge Bao deal extensively with this issue. After all, the criminals Judge Bao has to deal with are not only weird tigers and demonic carp, adulterous courtesans and murderous innkeepers, but high officials and imperial relatives. In the extensive literature on Judge Bao, this explicit interest in the issue of the authority and independence of the judge is, I think, unique for these ballad stories. This issue has two aspects. First, there are the steps the emperor can take to enhance the power of the judge vis-à-vis his fellow bureaucrats. And secondly, there are the ways in which the institutional position of the judge can be strengthened vis-à-vis the emperor and his kin. Of course, the judge's personal virtue, courage, probity, and incorruptibility have to be beyond reproach and instill respect and awe. But the ballad stories are more than other genres dealing with Judge, more than other genres dealing with Judge Power, aware that such personal qualities may not be enough to operate effectively as the embodiment of justice. Now, the first means to strengthen the authority of the judge is largely symbolic and consists in providing him with special instruments for torture and execution. In the Qing dynasty, Judge Bao can use as his special prerogative the three choppers, large enough to chop criminals in two at the waist, and designed to reflect the relative status if the criminals concerned. Judge Bao's choppers are a topic that has been researched in great detail by our colleague Vincent Durand-Dastet. In the ballad stories, which are earlier, these choppers are not yet mentioned. Here, Judge Bao has to be satisfied with more primitive instruments, such as cudgels, kangs, and chains, but like the choppers, adjusted to the status of the suspects. When the emperor provides Judge Bao with such special instruments of torture and execution, he usually also awards him the more important privilege of beheading first and reporting later. Xianjian Houzhou. This means that Judge Bao is allowed to execute the criminals he has condemned to death without submitting his judgments to his colleagues and his superiors for revision, which, as we saw, is standard procedure in late imperial time when the death sentence is involved. In the ballad stories, the early career of Judge Bao runs into trouble exactly when he executes a criminal without reporting the case to his superior, who, of course, promptly reports him for this major infraction of this basic rule of judicial administration. And then, as a result, Judge Bao is reprimanded and he retires from office. A second means to strengthen the authority and independence of the judge is to appoint him not only to high office, but to multiple high offices at the same time. In this way, conflict between bureaucrats of the same rank is, of course, avoided, and the person occupying these various offices concurrently can draw on the facilities of one office in dealing with the problems within another sphere. The use of this strategy is, however, not without irony. The historical Pao Zheng repeatedly attacked the use of multiple appointments. Once, when he had successfully stopped the appointment of one of his colleagues to three offices at the same time, he himself was appointed to the same three offices, which earned him a sharp rebuke from Ouyang Shou, and that left a permanent stain on his reputation as far as his fellow Northern Song bureaucrats were concerned. Whereas the above two procedures primarily serve to enhance the authority and independence of the judge via his fellow officials, a third procedure primarily serves to enhance his power vis-a-vis the emperor and his kin. This procedure involved boosting the number and the standing of the guarantors of the official concerned. In Song Dynasty bureaucratic practice, to act as a guarantor for a fellow official was not an empty gesture. The historical Pao Zheng was once set back in rank when an official for whom he acted as guarantor was condemned for some malfeasance. In the ballad stories, Judge Bao's guarantors include not only the highest officials of the land, but also some of the senior imperial relatives. The suggestion is that any action on the side of the emperor against Judge Bao would result in a decapitation of the imperial bureaucracy and bring the administration to a standstill. All these elements come very clearly together in the ballad story of Judge Bao selling rice in Chunzhou. Again, one encounters typos when one reads one's own writings. In the scene of his appointment. In the Zhaju dramatization of this story, as you may remember, Judge Bao is not eager to be dispatched to Chunzhou because he is 80 years old and has just returned from a long and tiring inspection trip through the southern regions of the empire. In the ballad story version, however, Judge Bao is only a young nobody. He may have the virtue and courage to confront the most powerfully connected persons in the realm, but he has no standing in the administration, as he has retired from service and is living in a local monastery as an acolyte after he was reprimanded and disciplined for overstepping the boundaries of his authority. When the emperor asks his officials who is capable of going to Chunzhou and dealing with the four corrupt imperial relatives there, none of his officials step forward, which provides Prime Minister Wang with the opportunity to propose the name of Judge Bao. And the text in the ballad story here in translation reads, starts with the speech of the emperor. Who is there among all the many officials, or who is the person among the many military officers? Who of the many officials at court is so highly capable he can be put in charge of the granaries and selling rice? None of the civil and military officials dared to answer. None of the many officials at court dared raise his voice. They knew how tough these four imperial relatives were, and even none of the capable court officials dared to go. The civil officials suddenly seemed to be molded of clay. The military officers all seemed to be carved from wood. The mouths of the civil officials were carved from wood. The lips of the military officers were stuck with glue. The emperor, the humane ancestor, was sorely vexed and cursed all officials and officers there present at court. In times of great peace, you just sit on your silver chairs, but in years of revolt and rebellion, you don't give a shit. As soon as the humane emperor, the humane ancestor, said this, one man stepped forward from the ranks of civil officials, a purple gown, an ivory tablet, a belt made of gold. And wishing his lord a myriad of years, he said, Your Majesty, here in front of the golden steps, I recommend a person to be put in charge of the granaries and selling rice. Those four imperial relatives in Chunzhou are tough. None of the civil officials and military officers at court dares to go. If some other person must be found to sell rice in Chunzhou, the only person who is fit for the job is that Bao Wenzhong. When the emperor, the humane ancestor, lifted his head, he found the speaker was Chancellor Wang from Qingzhou. When the prime minister brings Judge Bao to court, he instructs him that he should thank the emperor for his appointment only when he, the prime minister, nods his head. So when Judge Bao arrives at court and the emperor awards him a purple gown and a golden belt as sign of his favor when dispatching him to Chunzhou, Judge Bao refuses the appointment. And the ballad goes on. Three courtiers led him to the Golden Phoenix Hall. The loyal official was gifted a purple gown and a gold belt. After Bao Zheng had dressed himself in formal court dress, he bowed before his lord, bowing down 24 times. The emperor, the humane ancestor, proclaimed his edict, which was only addressed to the one person, Bao Wenzhong. We award you this purple gown and also this golden belt. Now you are put in charge of the granaries and selling rice. Having been told this, Lord Bao stepped forward and spoke. I wish your majesty a myriad of years. Please listen to me. How on earth could your servant dare go to Chunju? Over there, they are all golden branches and jade leaves. Golden branches and jade leaves is a common metaphor for imperial relatives. If your majesty dispatches your humble servant to that place, I'm bound to lose my life as soon as I arrive there in Chunju. There is really no harm in your majesty speaking the word to appoint me to yet higher office, so I will not be despised. The emperor then proceeds to appoint Judge Pao to 4 commissionerships, and when Judge Pao refuses to accept these appointments, the emperor adds another 4 commissionerships. And when even these 8 commissionerships are not enough, adds yet another 4 commissionerships. On top of that, Judge Pao receives the promise that upon his return to Chunju, he will be allowed to be behead those who transgress the law without first reporting the matters to the throne, and will be appointed as prefect of the capital prefecture of Kaifeng. When even so, Judge Pao does not yet accept the appointment, because Prime Minister Wang does not yet tell him to do so, Judge Pao is also granted a set of magical weapons and provided with 10 very special guarantors. And so the ballad goes on. Lord Pao didn't dare step forward to express gratitude and bow. He still didn't dare express his thanks in front of the golden steps. The emperor, the humane ancestor, felt depressed in his heart and addressed the following question to that Pao Wenzhong. We have appointed you to the most distinguished offices, so why do you still not express your thanks for our grace? The Prime Minister Chancellor Wang stepped forward saying, may your majesty live a myriad of years. Please listen to me. When Lord Pao is to go to Chunju, it is absolutely necessary that he has the following 8 magical weapons at his disposal. A big kang made of pine wood and also a pine wood cudgel in case he has to sentence common people who commit injustice. A big kang of black lacquer and also a black lacquered cudgel in case he has to sentence high officials and prime ministers. A big kang made of yellow wood and also a yellow wood cudgel in case he has to sentence imperial kin and dynastic relatives. And a big kang of peach wood and also a peach wood cudgel in case he has to sentence gods and ghosts at night by lamplight. Moreover, he also needs an imperial battle flag and a sword with which to decapitate imperial kin and dynastic relatives. 10 officials here at court will serve as his guarantors, and your majesty will also sign that document with his thumb. In case one of the imperial relatives will kill Pao Wenzhong, we will report to your majesty but act on our own initiative. The emperor, the humane ancestor, accepted this proposal. Who are the 10 officials then who will be his guarantors? The Prime Minister, Chancellor Wang, stepped forward saying, your humble servant is willing to be one of the guarantors. So the first guarantor was His Excellency Chancellor Wang. The second guarantor was Commander-in-Chief General Fan. The third was Commandant Eskert Han of the headquarters. And the fourth guarantor was His Excellency Chancellor Yao. Prince Li of the Central Garrison was the 5th guarantor, while Prince Qian of Eastern and Western Zhe was the 6th guarantor. The 7th was the Commandant Escort Chai of Dongjing, and the 8th guarantor was the Vice Premier surnamed Qian. The 9th guarantor was His Excellency the Chancellor Tao, and the 10th guarantor was the Grand Palace Eunuch Miao. These 10 guarantors all put their thumb on the document, and His Majesty the Emperor also added his thumb to it. This document they presented to the pure official Pao Zheng so he could take charge of the granaries and selling rice. When Lord Pao looked at His Excellency Chancellor Wang, his head only now did shake, instructing him to make his bows. With his bows, he thanked the emperor, the humane ancestor, who offered his beloved servant 3 cups of imperial wine. So we see how Judge Bao is presented with symbolic and real exceptional instruments of torture and execution, and is appointed to a total of 12 high offices concurrently. His position is further bolstered by the appointment of 10 guarantors who present the highest ranking officials, eunuchs, and imperial relatives. Moreover, all these officials sign a contractual agreement that they will take action in case something happens to Judge Bao and insist that the emperor co-signs their contract with his own thumbprint. With his independence guaranteed by these institutional means, Judge Bao is ready then for his confrontation the next day with concubine Chang, who sports the insignia of Empress Cao. And when the concubine complains to her husband, he is, of course, annoyed. And the ballad says, Her Majesty immediately returned to the imperial palace, wishing the emperor a myriad of years, reported to him, As soon as you have appointed that Bao to high office, he starts to bully and abuse people out on the streets. He robbed my yellow gaze, caught gold-speckled parasols, and scattered the frightened ladies-in-waiting and maids. The emperor, the humane ancestor, was very annoyed that Bao Wenzheng is really an insupportable person. He doesn't go off to Chunzhou to supervise the selling of rice, but bullies my ladies from the inner apartments of the palace. You, my darling, now better go back to your own palace, and we will summon that Lord Bao and ask him for his reasons. When the emperor, the humane ancestor, heard her story, he summoned him to the hall and submitted him to question. And when Lord Bao arrived in front of the golden steps, he reported by wishing his enlightened ruler a myriad of years. The humane ancestor was very annoyed and loudly started to revile that one man, Bao Wenzheng. Bullying and abusing Empress Zhang of the side palace is just like bullying and abusing us, your lord and master. But an unfazed Judge Bao proceeds to give a lecture to the emperor on ritual propriety and finds both concubine Zhang and Empress Cao a hefty amount of money, which he doesn't keep to himself, but distributes to the troops. In the tale of the dragon design, Bao sentencing the emperor's brothers-in-law, Judge Bao even slaps a fine of 30,000 strings of cash and 100 ounces of silver and gold on the emperor when the latter leaves the palace and visits Kaifeng prefectural officers to intercede on behalf of his brothers-in-law. Again, the money, the fines imposed on the imperial family in these ballad stories are then distributed amongst the troops, which means that the army has a great interest in fines imposed on the imperial family and maybe another bulwark for the bureaucracy against the emperor and the members of the imperial family and certain other aspects of the bureaucracy. While Judge Bao's personal character and the symbolic and institutional means may collaborate in ensuring the authority and independence of Judge Bao, they do not produce due process of law. Judge Bao is not only the judge, but also the prosecutor in his own court, and a belief in his own moral rectitude that makes him such an impartial judge also makes him an implacable prosecutor. Judge Bao knows that his suspects are criminals. After all, he often has been informed of their identity by the ghost of his victims, and he will use every trick in the book to imprison them in his own jail and to extract a confession. Our ballad stories stress again and again that arresting the suspect is not an easy matter. Not because their whereabouts are not known, but, as I have discussed elsewhere, because they move around town accompanied by a few hundred tough armed bodyguards. Judge Bao will send fake letters, feign illness, and even simulate his own death to trick the criminals into stepping into his yamen. Once Judge Bao has succeeded, however, in separating the men from his guards, he will subject his suspects to any kind of court torture in order to extract a confession. As is well known, such a confession is needed in Chinese legal procedure to conclude a case, and Judge Bao's opponents know as well as he that he cannot sentence them as long as they refuse to confess to the crimes they are accused of. While Judge Bao, in his confrontations with the emperor and his kin, is adamant that all laws and regulations should be strictly followed, the laws and regulations concerning judicial torture clearly do not apply to him. The anonymous authors of the ballot stories describe the various tortures of stubborn suspects, not only in great detail, but also with obvious pleasure. When torture will not extract a confession, Judge Bao will try to scare his opponents into a confession by having prison guards impersonate the ghosts of their victims, or he will himself impersonate the kings of hell. In recent scholarship, much has been made of the formal restrictions on the use of torture in Chinese law. And yes, the law restricts the use of torture, but these ballot stories, and actually not only these ballot stories, but the whole Judge Bao tradition shows that Judge Bao is not bound by these rules, but will use any kind of torture which will extract a confession, and apparently that is justified because we all know that the victims of these torture are criminals who have committed terrible crimes. While closed in the most orthodox morality, one cannot but feel sometimes that Judge Bao's eagerness to bring the high and mighty to justice is partly fueled by what one could call class resentment. Judge Bao is an upstart who entered the bureaucracy by his spectacular success in the examinations. In the tale of the early career of Rescriptor Bao, we learn that he was born as the third son of a rich farmer. At birth, the infant is so ugly that his father wants to abandon him, but he is raised by his sister-in-law. While his father has him herd cows, his sister-in-law sees to it that he acquires an education. When he arrives at the capital, Kaifeng, to take the examinations, he cannot find any decent accommodation and is taken in by a courtesan from his hometown who had been kidnapped as a girl. As an upstart, Judge Bao is very much seen as an interloper by the established bureaucracy. When in the tale of Dragon Design Bao sentencing the emperor's brothers-in-law, Judge Bao pays a call on Lady Cao, the emperor's mother-in-law, she refuses to accept his housewarming gifts and reviles him in the following words. Her ladyship thereupon ranted in a language most foul. She immediately started to curse Judge Bao. "You beast! Down in the countryside, your father is a village chief, and your mother weaves linen and picks mulberry leaves. Your elder brother operates a pawn shop in the village. Your second brother sells booze in the village to the west. When you grew up, you were the third son, imbecile Bao. you recited a classic of filial piety while herding cows. On behalf of others, you held the inkstone and wrapped ink. You filled the inkstone with water in the service of others. When you heard that your humane ancestor held an exam, you jumped across the Dragon Gate with brush and paper. Now you may, out of the blue, have obtained some office, reported by wishing. I see. I am reading my paper in the wrong order of pages. It must have happened sometime. Okay. So. Okay. Now you may out of the blue have obtained some office, but you are less than the dust below the sole of my shoes. Cursed like this, Judge Bao did not know how to reply, and flustered and flurried, he fled from the Cao mansion. Outside the gate, he hastily mounted his sedan chair, and filled with hatred, he repeatedly gnashed his teeth. If I do not sentence and cut off this Cao family mansion, I am not worthy to be the prefect of Kaifeng Prefecture. When her eldest son warns Lady Cao against Judge Bao, his mother repeats her contempt for this imbecile Bao. The imperial brother-in-law folded his hands, saying, "My dear mother, please listen to what I will say. The prefect of Kaifeng Prefecture, that Judge Bao, does not come to our mansion without some reason. My dear mother, why did you have to curse him when he brought housewarming gifts, lamp, and wine? My younger brother has committed a capital crime, and I'm afraid that this Bao may have heard about it. If indeed the Judge Bao comes to learn all the facts, second brother is bound to leave for the Lord of Shade. My heart is overcome by fear that iron-faced Bao. My heart is overcome by fear of that iron-faced Bao. I'm filled by anxious thoughts, depressed and down." When she heard this, her ladyship laughed heartily, and she said with a smile, "My dear son, don't worry. Your sister's husband is the current son of heaven. Your elder sister is the emperor's wife. You are the transport commissioner for Jiangnan. Your younger brother is the governor of Zhengzhou. I myself am the mother-in-law of a lord and king. We are the highest ranking relatives of His Majesty. In my eyes, that imbecile Bao is not even worse. The dust at the tip of my shoes are under my heels. My dear son, if you speak fearful language like this, you diminish the force of your own vital energy." Her son then proceeds to provide a catalogue of actions of Judge Bao against imperial relatives, starting from his confrontation with concubine Zhang, but listing some 10 more cases, and concludes in the following way. He loves to sentence the emperor's kin and relatives. This Judge Bao is truly bereft of all common sense. The 400 civil and military officials at court and the emperor's kith and kin all fear this man Bao. Intelligent and incorruptible, without any partiality, he sentences the living by day and ghosts by night. When the emperor saw how pure and upright he was, our lord and king bestowed on him a golden tablet. On that tablet, the king wrote a column of characters. Irrespective of one's status of imperial relative, empress, imperial concubine, or prime minister, whoever breaks the law, all will be treated equally. Now, the eldest of the Cao brothers is portrayed as a shrewd and careful man in a text that chooses its word carefully. Judge Bao may be intelligent and incorruptible without any partiality. He also loves to sentence the emperor's kin and relatives. Perhaps the fear that speaks from the words of the older Cao brother teaches the reader that institutional arrangements can all be undone unless the positions are filled with special. Judicial authority and independence will only function as long as the judge derives a deep satisfaction, will only function as long as the judges derive a deep satisfaction from their activities. This awareness, together with the traditional Chinese emphasis on the rule by man, may well be part of the explanation why in later centuries narratives on Judge Bao lose the interest we noticed in the ballad stories in the institutional aspects of ensuring judicial authority and independence. One may also wonder what Ming and Qing readers, who were accustomed to far more autocratic imperial rule, thought of an emperor who entered into a contractual agreement with his officials to uphold the authority and independence of a judge who was likely to execute his closest relatives. But once the authors of crime narratives lose an interest in the institutional arrangement needed to ensure the authority and independence of judges, we witness the birth of the stereotype of the pure official, the Qingquan, whose only source of strength is his own moral character. Thank you very much.